Good morning, world travelers and diners. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Good morning, Rabbit.
And this is not a secret anymore, listeners, because I'm going to tell you the secret. This is the fourth time we started recording this program because Ann had a fit of the giggles, but that's
which
okay.
I tend to get, but anyhow, and that's probably because I'm just so happy.
So On the Menu, anyway, On the Menu continues the story of our recent visit to London. And
one of the places I love going to every time we're in London is Borough Market.
Yeah, to revisit our favorite place. Now, we will give you a tip here because I don't think it's mentioned anywhere in the interviews they recorded, but the market is now open to the public on Thursday. They had already added Friday. Saturday, the market is open only for tourists. So if you're going to go there, go on Thursday or Friday because Saturday is apparently madness. Nobody buys anything. Everybody just gets in everybody's way. But we make a point of going there.
And revisiting old friends and who have the stalls there, although they're getting moved around quite a lot because of they're adding a track and they're doing some remodeling. And I think they're kind of gentrifying a little bit too, if I might be honest.
Well, I think that the market is smartening up a little bit, and maybe one of its charms was that it was a little bit decrepit. But anyway,
they were going to tear it down, and
anyway,
it's been rescued.
We took the opportunity to visit with a few stallholders before, even on Thursday, it got to be too busy for us to be able to set up the equipment and record easily. So we've got one old friend and two new friends to introduce to you, Tony Booth from the Wild Mushroom Company, followed by somebody's name I can't remember from a company called Shell Seekers, but his name's in the interview anyway. And then finally, a gentleman who now owns a company called Mrs. Smith's Pies, where they sell that legendary delicacy, the English pork pie. So we're going to put those back-to-back just so that you get a flavor of what it would be like as you went from one store to the other in the market and had a chance to talk to people yourselves.
We've been trying to get Tony Booth, the owner of the Wild Mushroom Company, to talk to us for years here at the Borough Market, but he's always been too busy. Fortunately, this year we came on a Friday, so he has a few minutes to talk to us. Tony, welcome to On the Menu.
Fine. I'm Tony Booth. I've been in the Borough Market since it opened its retail side, which was 10 years ago. I thought 10 years ago I'd take things easy and retire, but the atmosphere here is too good to retire from. I find it's like being on holiday every day, but that's my opinion of it. Other people would think I'm mad and it's too much hard work.
Now, the market, I understand, the hours have extended now, so are you here on Thursdays, Fridays and Saturdays?
We're actually here from Wednesday, but we do a wholesale side to restaurants, and I'm actually working from Monday through till Saturday.
And you have just a wonderful lineup of produce here. What are some of that? We just saw some pea eggplant, which we've never seen before. Some interesting other new things?
Yes, pea eggplants actually come from Thailand. We have them shipped in once a week. And it's like everything in England. There's so many cultures now. Everybody wants their own food. We've got one of the most old-fashioned vegetables in England, which is sea cow. Unfortunately, there's only one person left in England who grows it. And I'm saying England, and that's a lie really, because it's Scotland. But for that particular reason of sea cow, we call it English.
And you've got some fabulous looking asparagus here, which would drive Frenchmen and women wild. That must be new season too?
That's new season, and it comes from the south of France. It will move up in France to the Loire, which is much far better, I think, far better quality. But at the moment, we're still dealing from the south of France, and another month we'll be into the Loire Valley asparagus.
And just to the left of it, you've got some asparagus from Cornwall. So it's from England too.
The first comes from Cornwall because Cornwall's climate is slightly warmer. And now they realise it's got a microclimate, and they can grow asparagus out of seed, just out of season. And it arrives 3 weeks before the main crop. And it's not as good as the main crop, but it's a substitute. And the thing with English asparagus, it takes longer to grow. It's got a much more dense flavour.
Did you ask, Rabbit, how many varieties of mushrooms you have? And can you run through just some of the types?
At the moment of wild mushrooms, we've only got four varieties that are good. Due in the season, we will have up to 20 varieties. But at the moment, we've got morels, chanterelles from America, from Northern California, trumpet, or trumpet of death, they're from California. We've got giroles, and sep. The sep are South African mushrooms, and it's the end of their season.
You've got the blue foot, or it's
pied de bleu? Pied de bleu, but blue foot, but it's cultivated.
And what is a horse mushroom?
It's an old-fashioned field mushroom that grows completely different to a flat mushroom, but now is cultivated in Holland.
But oyster mushrooms, you've got the enoki mushrooms, king oysters from Korea. Oh, this is absolute heaven for me. I wanted to ask another question. Do you happen to have stinging nettles?
Yes, we have stinging nettles. They're just coming into season, and it's the only time of year you should eat them, when the young shoots are coming through.
How do you think I figured out that what I was touching was a stinging nettle?
Well, you soon found out.
I'll learn to keep my hands off of your produce. Tony, I'm going to give this back to Peter.
Good news, West Virginians. They grow something similar to ramps here, and they're in season, so... if you were over here now, you'd be able to have a festival already. Tony, it's so great to catch up with you. How many years are you going to continue to be here?
Until I get fed up. But I don't know how long that's going to be. I think I've got a few years to go, a few more ideas.
Well, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday open to the public at the Borough Market. You have to find the Wild Mushroom Company. Everybody knows where it is because they're one of the original tenants. They moved a few years ago. They've got a grand-looking space. It's just something that you shouldn't miss. Tony, say goodbye.
Goodbye, and good luck.
Chris Brown and his brother have a very popular stall in at Borough Market called Shell Seekers. I wasn't sure I was going to get that out. Hi, Chris.
Hi, how's it going?
I'm interested, one of your specialties, of course, this is the gorgeous fresh seafood, shellfish in particular, particularly among shellfish scallops. I understand you have a rather extraordinary routine for bringing in fresh scallops. Could you tell us about it?
Yeah, well, we start off usually about Monday morning, travel down to Dartmouth at the moment. We're traveling down there. It's about 35, 40 miles away from Dorset into Devon. The boat is in Dartmouth at the moment. We travel down to Dartmouth. My brother's, he's a diver. I'm the driver of the boat. So we go down there and we get up usually, like say, about 7 or 8 in the morning, drive on down, get in the boat and then shoot on down. At the moment we're diving off Star Point. We drive on, so it's probably about 15 miles up the coast we travel. We're in about 15 to 18 meters of water and then brother goes down. He can be down for about hour and a half, sends up lifting bags, which are like a ring bag, net bag. He goes along the bottom, picks up the scallops, puts them in the bag, puts a bit of air in the bag, and sends it up to the surface. Me and his girlfriend are gauging them for different sizes, from medium to small to large to XL, which you get quite big scallops down in Dartmouth at this time of year. We're down there to about beginning of June, and then we have to that's our season finished down there. We have to travel back up to Lulworth Cove, and then we fish out of Lulworth Cove.
Well, now how many scallops do you get in a single dive?
Between 80 and 90 dozen scallops in them. You know, about 3 or 4 bags full.
And you couldn't get them fresher, could you?
No. Well, we take them back. We store them in off the boat when we're moored down there. Until we dive for about up to 2 to 3 days down there. And then what we do is we travel back with a refrigerated van. And then we've got tanks with seawater in, which we, like the tank with the lobsters in. And we put the scallops in and they're fresh. When I brought them up this morning, they were clapping when I got them out of the tank.
Oh, they were clapping. That's great. They were happy to be here.
Yeah.
Any other unusual fish or shellfish you sell?
We do a lot of, we do crab. We do spider crab. We're going to catch a lot in the summer. They come in to breed, so in the short, into shallow waters, we get spider crab coming in now. It's all seasonal, really. We've just had plaice, which have been in season, which have had all the roe, so they've been quite big. And plaice, and then come summertime, we'll get a lot of bass. We go fishing for bass as well, off the coast, off Portland Bill.
Well, this looks like, I wish I were cooking. I just take half of this shop home. Thanks for taking the time to talk to it.
Not a problem. Yeah, anytime.
Well, Mrs. King's pork pies go back to the 1850s. But a Mr. Hartland owns the business today. I'm going to ask him to introduce himself and explain what his take is on the business. Oh, and I forgot, by the way, we're at Borough Market, one of the most important stalls, selling a very traditional English product.
Hello, my name's Neil Hartland from Elizabeth King, Mrs. Elizabeth King, sorry. We sell traditional handcrafted Melton Mowbray pork pies.
Now, why Melton Mowbray in particular?
Melton Mowbray is a town in Leicestershire, and its association is with the fox hunting fraternity, who used to eat the pork pie as a snack when they were on the hoof. Predominantly, the gentry of London used to partake in the pork pie.
So they were crafted that way so that you could eat them while you were sitting on your horse?
Yeah, it's basically, like most pies, the pastry was purely superficial to protect the meat, and that was discarded, and that is why the crust is quite a strong crust. Same with the Cornish pasties with the miners. The pastry was purely to protect the inside of the pie.
And so they actually threw the crust away?
The crust was just thrown away, discarded, not worth eating. And then obviously, through the generations, people started to develop pastries, and people got an acquired taste for it.
Now, we did read somewhere that the reason that there's an edge on the Cornish pasties was so that the miners would be able to hold them without making the rest of the pasty dirty. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. And also, the Cornish pasty traditionally was half savoury and half sweet. That's why, I don't know why it's called mincemeat, but that was traditionally how you ate it, so all your meal was in one convenient package.
Now, you don't make them like that anymore, though?
We still make Cornish pasties, but not to the traditional Cornish recipe, because we're not from the area. So, as with the Mountain Mowbray pork pies, we try and keep everything regional.
Well, listeners, when you're on the street edge, now tell me what the street is on the side here.
That is Stony Street, I think, with a couple of beer pubs on it. Quite a lot of filming is done here. Harry Potter was filmed out there. It's a very, very, very busy street early in the morning when all the fruit and veg is being delivered from all over the world.
Yeah, the naked chef Jamie Oliver here once a few years ago. So anyway, it's on that side. It's called Mrs. King's Pies. People say they're an acquired taste, but I'm looking at one that has venison, pheasant, rabbit and pigeon. It's a no-fail, and Neil had to rush over to see a customer, so Neil, we're gonna sign off because we don't want to interfere with business.
And I think that sets us up for a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back to On the Menu. Don't forget to email us at any time. The email address is onthemenu@onthemenuradio.com. We're still interviewing people at this point in Borough Market, and we're going to be talking to somebody who's been long involved with the market. And also, I must say that we were his guest and companion at lunch at his restaurant called Roast, and I loved it. I had the best time and had the best food and just absolutely adored it.
Iqbal's a very interesting fellow. He's always interested in a new trend, so he said, would you like to try British wine? So, of course, we did.
Yeah.
And it was quite excellent.
It used to be a joke, then
the sommelier came over with a wine that Iqbal hadn't tried because it was new, and it turned out it was from Puglia. It was a Primitivo from Puglia. So everything's up to date in London City at the Borough Market and at this beautiful, beautiful restaurant space called Roast. It sits on the second floor up above the market, and we've actually found out from Iqbal that the facade for the flower market was actually originally built for a flower market in Covent Garden. It didn't fit there, so they put it away into what you might call mothballs, and when he was looking to have the restaurant created, when they created a restaurant, because it was already there, and he was a successful bidder to actually operate it, they found this old frontage, which is very Victorian-looking and fit to a T. But the inside is a creation of Iqbal and his colleagues at Glorious Group.
It's
the name of his restaurant. It's a winner. Chef Lawrence.
Jammed with people.
Yeah, Chef Lawrence Keogh. We must say hello to Chef Lawrence once again.
Fine job, chef.
Yeah, halfway through lunch, somebody came over and told Iqbal they'd done 180 covers today in a restaurant that seats 110. So it's a busy place. We don't say this in the interview, but it would be a good idea if you wanted to make sure you get in to make a reservation, because it's a happening spot. It was a happening spot. He recorded this interview at almost 4 o'clock in the afternoon after lunch. So here's Iqbal.
From the tracks we've already played, you probably, listeners, have a sense that the Borough Market, which used to be called the Food Basket of London, is a really very special place, which reopened really only about 10 years ago. It's an amazing spot, but it wouldn't be complete without something that was added just 2.5 years ago. We're talking to Iqbal Wahab. Iqbal, tell us what happened.
Well, Borough Market has been going for about 250 years. It's the oldest food market in Britain. And about 10 years ago, Britain started to realize what it was like to have a food culture. We'd been always been embarrassed about our food in the past. And suddenly there was the awareness that was brought about very sadly by the mad cow disease. And we suddenly understood that if we asked for cheap produce, we would get bad produce. Cattle would die, and literally millions of cows were dying. And we suddenly understood that we have to put more effort into what we understand about our food. And that's what made Borough Market come about. The quality food producers of this country were coming down here from all over the Britain. And people started to come and shop here. But it took the trustees and it took the producers to actually convince people. And once they did, Borough Market trustees then built a restaurant and asked for restaurateurs to come along and say, what is it that you can do to enhance the Borough Market experience? And luckily, that's how Roast is here today, and I'm very happy with it.
Now, the we's included you, because you were yourself a trustee, correct?
Well, I'm very much involved with how Borough Market promotes itself and how it becomes part of the community around it, because food can't just be seen in isolation of the people who live and experience it and who work around you. And one of the problems that we have around Borough Market is that there are very deprived communities in this area, and so we have to find ways in which to engage them. And that's what I do, is that whilst I sell very expensive and very high quality food, I also feel there's a responsibility in me to engage with local unemployed people and local young kids and make them feel aware of what it is that Borough Market's about and what British food is about.
Now, this is the market, we agreed, and you can confirm this, that if you're a member of the general public and you don't want to be mobbed with tourists, the better times to come here on Thursdays, on the Fridays. Saturdays are a little busy.
Suddenly, over the last 2 or 3 years, you've seen that on a Saturday in Borough Market, you will see 10,000 people shopping, which is a huge number of people. Some would say too many people. The market's now open on a Friday and has even recently started open on a Thursday, purely to allow shoppers to engage in a proper experience of being able to engage with the producers who are here and understand the produce they have and be able to buy from them. Because on a Saturday, when there's so many people here, a lot of them are tourists taking pictures and shoppers can't buy the food that they want to. So it's great that we're opening more often, because we can all have a much fuller experience of what the Borough Market's about.
But the great news is you can come to Roast anytime, because this is a 7-day-a-week, morning till night operation. Tell us a little more about that, Iqbal.
Well, what we love about being involved in the market is that we have a market that's working all day, and we interact with the market so much that we stay open all day as well. So we're open for breakfast, lunch, and dinner all the time. You can always come eat something here. If you come at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, you can have pork chipolatas and Worcester sauce or scotch eggs at the bar, or you can have organic free-range chickens roasted to perfection in the evening or lunchtime. And in the morning we have a great bangers and mash thing. We have everything going to celebrate what British food is all about. And that's what's so exciting about being in the market. You couldn't do this anywhere else. If I was 1 mile down the road, I wouldn't be able to do that.
So this is the place. Opens up for breakfast, it opens for lunch, it opens for dinner, it opens 7 days a week. It's lunchtime now. Listeners, I have to tell you, it's almost 10 minutes after 4 in the afternoon. Half the tables are still busy. Perhaps people are not planning to eat dinner, or they're just having a wonderful time at lunchtime. This is a place to see. It's a delightful space. It's a wonderful menu. If you go back to last year's programs, Chef Lawrence Keough is still too busy in the kitchen to come out, talks about what it's like to cook here. And Iqbal, shall we keep your future ventures a secret?
We'll keep my future ventures alive. That's the most important thing.
So expect some news from this side of the pond, and possibly the other side of the pond, as Iqbal Wahab gets involved in some more things. Miss Annie's over here on my left, just putting down a cup of green tea, so she has to be required to say a word before we close.
I mean, I am so happy. Every single thing you would want, from green tea to just lemon wedges in your salad, if you're that eccentric as I am. Everything's perfect. I love it. Thank you.
A last thought for everybody, Iqbal.
I think British food has finally had its opportunity to have a renaissance, for people to recognize that there is quality rather than embarrassment involved in British food. And hopefully more and more people will come to understand that British food is something that we can celebrate and enjoy rather than cry away from. And let's globalize it. Let's take it abroad. Let's get more people engaged in what we do, both in terms of the produce and in terms of the cooking.
But in the meantime, if you want to check it out, come to Roast at the Borough Market. It's just around the corner from the London Bridge Underground Station on the Jubilee Line. Listeners, your trip to London is not complete until you come here.
On the Menu loves London's markets. We love the markets of any city around the world, and in particular just loves poking around, seeing how fresh the produce is and what's for sale and all that kind of thing. So we went to another market site on the Saturday of our visit to London, but it turned out it was a day when the market wasn't operating. But it didn't really matter, because that wasn't our mission. Our mission was to meet the founding chef of a chain of now some 10 they're fast food stores, but they're fast food places with
a
difference.
But they're healthy, fresh. Well, it's a grand concept.
It's fast food with a difference. The place is called Leon, and we had the opportunity to not only sample the food, but also to talk to Ben Pavarelli, who's a chef who's been with the organization since the very beginning.
We hope Benny Pavarelli is going to have a better day. Ben is the chef and the representative of a wonderful chain of food establishments in London called Leon, and while we were waiting to record this, we had an episode with a cappuccino, but we all took it in good spirit. We wiped the cappuccino off the computer. Benny wiped the cappuccino off his clothes, and he's here talking to us now about a really exciting and interesting, can I call it a chain? What should I call it, Benny?
Yeah, no, I think a chain's a good thing to call it. It will be a chain because we want to get, obviously, great food out to as many people as possible. So therefore, to do that, we need lots of these restaurants in everywhere, really. So any occasion, you can pop down to a Leon and we'll be there for you.
And the great thing is there are nine, and they're in the parts of London where business people go, but they're also in the parts of London where tourists tend to go too, right?
That's correct, yeah. I mean, we have quite a few in the city. We've got a couple in the West End, so both for workers, people who are out for the evening, whether it be tourists or people going to the theatre or onto somewhere else. We're also obviously sat in one that's in Spitalfields Market, which obviously services the local people, but as well as tourists come to see, get a good snapshot of London's markets, etc. But we aim to be wherever one is needed, really, on most high streets, in areas of interest, etc. You never know, you may see us in airports.
And you've been here almost since the beginning of the formation of the team.
Yeah, no, I started 6 months before we opened our first one in Carnaby Street in June 2004. It's been a very interesting experience and a journey for myself as well, and just to see how Leon has grown into something amazing.
Could you concisely explain concept of Leon? You are a chef, and you're responsible for a lot of the development of recipes, right?
Yeah, I also share the development with our kind of development chef, Allegra McEverdy, who created Leon's food identity back when we started, and I work very closely with Allegra, and we're developing. I probably do about 25% of the menu development, and Allegra does the rest. But she'll come with an idea, and then I'll kind of take it and scale it up, really, so and make it and get it into the restaurants and get it out there to the people.
And the concept?
Leon's concept started with John and Henry and Allegra, who are the founders, and then I joined 6 months into the project. And the concept, we were all kind of fed up with eating sandwiches in plastic, going to a service station where you couldn't really get anything wholesome to eat that you knew that was going to do you good. It was all just either deep fried in two slices of bread, etc. So we basically just wanted to get amazing food out to the masses. So we very simply just looked at amazing ingredients. So we know where our chickens come from, etc. We try and find as much about our food so we don't compromise on those. And then we also wanted to make sure that our restaurants suited all experiences. So if in the morning you had a spare half an hour away from work, you can come in and get a latte and a muffin, or even come and get a sausage bap. Or if you're in a rush, you come in, you grab your coffee, you go back to your desk, and you've got a little bit of sunshine in your life. And then at lunchtime, the same thing, really. If you want to come in, you can sit down. It's a nice kind of atmosphere. It's relaxed. It's not full of plastic chairs. It's a very kind of family-filled environment. And hopefully a little bit of sunshine into your life. And then in the evening, if you after work, you may want to come and relax and have a beer. You can do that. We serve little mezze, as well as you can get some of the lunchtime food as well.
What about the specific items here? What are your signatures?
One of our signatures that's been right from the start, that there was myself, Allegra, Henry was there, and a guy called Fred, Allegra's friend, and we worked on our Moroccan meatballs. There was a lot of love went into those meatballs, developing them, make sure they were the right size, make sure they were soft enough, etc. And they're in a spicy Moroccan tomato sauce. And we get through a lot of those. There's a lot of rolling meatballs that happens.
And what about your superfood salads?
Yeah, the superfood salads, obviously superfoods are very popular at the moment, but they just happen to be superfoods, and that's why we like to feature them in our salads. Things as broccoli, spinach, quinoa. And the one that's been on the menu since the very start is the Leon's original superfood salad, which contains broccoli, quinoa, it's got peas in there, some feta for a little bit of saltiness, and alfalfa, so a nice sprouting seed for a bit of crunch, etc., and then just very simply dressed with a house dressing.
You do wraps?
Yeah, we do wraps. We've just recently launched Leon's new wraps, which are much bigger and better, good value for money, and a lot hotter. They come in a large Kobez bread, which is a Turkish flatbread. You can either get that with our grilled chicken, and they all come with a white bean and rosemary puree, so a little bit of sort of Italian inspired. And then it's got a crunchy slaw, just very simply dressed with red wine vinegar and a touch of salt. And then you can either get it with a Mexican salsa, so all the classic salsa ingredients there, loads of coriander and lime, and a little bit of spring onion and chili. And they're great and very filling.
And what about these codes? Tell us about that.
So at Leon, we wanted to have all the answers to what people wanted to know, but we didn't want to particularly ram it down their throats. So obviously we choose great things, and anything that comes onto Leon's menu is naturally good for you. We won't put any bad things on there, so we don't use deep fat fryers, etc. We roast or we grill. And for easy identification from the people who eat with us, we've created a selection of little icons. They very quickly tell you what it can do for you, or what's in it, or if you shouldn't eat it if you have a particular dietary requirement. So we've got things like a heart, which means no or low animal fat. There's a tick, which says it's either got good carbs or good sugars. With good sugars, we only use fructose, which is a natural fruit sugar, so you don't get that sugary high that you get with other sugary, unnatural sugars, should I say, sorry. And obviously there's a big thing for wheat-free, dairy-free, and gluten-free. And we just like to give our customers as much information in a quick snapshot. If they require more information, then we're more than happy to tell them, but we don't feel like we want to give them a lecture at every opportunity. So we have all the information, our team are very well informed. So if people need to know, we can tell them. We've got the answers. We've got nothing to hide. Very often we'll have people who eat with us, they'll email us and ask us for a recipe. We're not too closely guarded on that. We'll give them the list of ingredients and some home size weights that they can use. So hopefully they can get the experience there. We don't guard things too much. We're not some big corporation with burly security guards outside saying, no, you won't get our recipes.
Well, I think it's a young, vibrant operation here, and I predict it's going to be It's already successful. It has gotten great reviews, but I think you're going to get bigger. Thanks, by the way, for talking to us, and we can't wait to taste the food.
Thank you very much.
Well, what happened with the food actually was that he brought one of absolutely everything that the kitchen made out in little cardboard containers, et cetera, on the table, and I've never seen anything like it.
You've heard of a plateful. We had a tableful.
We had two tables full, if you remember.
But everything was really excellent. The chain is continuing to expand.
It's a winner. I mean,
The good news is that there's a Leon near most every place you'd like to go. There's a Leon near Borough Market and the Tate Modern. There's a Borough in the city. There's a Leon in the city near St. Paul's. There's a Leon in the West End. It was the very first one on Carnaby Street.
They're all related, but they have little touches relating to the area that they're in. I mean, some sell wine and some don't. It's an internet accessible site.
One of the wonderful things was they actually have free Wi-Fi, so that's a big bargain in London.
Well, this was a discovery. Yeah. It was a real discovery, and I think it's particularly good for people traveling with kids. I mean, kids of all ages, even teenagers and whatnot, because you get a good quantity of good stuff.
And this was a really happening place, and we know from what Benny told us that the chain is going to expand. It's actually going to be in markets outside of London in the near future. So pencil Leon in if you're looking for fast food, but fast food that's healthy, fast food with a difference.
And now it's time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Thank you for staying around, but will you come with us now to another happy, happy find, the Goring Hotel, its kitchen and dining rooms. Tell us about it, Rabbit.
Well, it's about as different than Leon as you can get, because certainly there wasn't fast food around when this hotel was originally founded in the 19th century. It's now in the fifth generation of ownership by the same family. And a very special story. And to tell us about that, Michael Bevan, the director of marketing for the Goring. Anne said, why don't you put your headset on? So if I mess this up, it's only my fault because I don't have my headset on. but here I am at the Goring Hotel, a small stone's throw from the backyard of Buckingham Palace. And I'm talking to Michael J. Fox's younger brother, who it turns out is named Michael Bevan, director of communications for a hotel that will experience its centenary. Absolutely. In 2010. But get this, listeners, it's been in the same family since 1910, when Otto Goring thought he had a chance to build a hotel in an area of London that was at that time slightly run down. It sure as hell isn't run down anymore. This is how this whole enterprise got started. Four generations later, Jeremy Goring is in charge. And Michael is here as director of communications from a life in the movie business, which we talked about. But this is a truly fascinating place. Michael, give us the elevator speech.
The elevator speech. A little history of how the hotel first came about, and a little potted history over our 100 years. Gosh, well, as you mentioned, the hotel was built in 1910, and Otto built the last grand Edwardian hotel of that period. And very shortly after the hotel was opened, King Edward passed away. And things changed an awful lot. So from day one, it was a very special place. It was, as you say, just across from the back of Buckingham Palace, from the Royal Mews. So purely a row of stables separated us from their backyard. And their back garden, and literally the last 98 years has been rather a charming sort of run through the sort of people that come to London and who have stayed maybe there at Buckingham Palace. It was rather charmingly known as Buckingham Palace's annex for many, many years, and in fact a number of visiting heads of state would request that they could actually have their rooms here at the Goring rather than at the palace, because we had a bathroom with every single room here, which the palace didn't.
which I guess they didn't. But get this, listeners. The key thing is that it's still here.
Absolutely.
Lots of family-owned hotels with famous names like the Savoy and Claridge's and the Connaught have all gone the corporate way. Here it's still the same. Michael, you said when people check in, it's sort of like they're coming into the Goring house as a visitor.
The Goring family are absolutely passionate that because their name is above the door, it simply is an invitation to come and be their house guest and to stay with them in their London home. And everything that we do here is very much based on that kind of mentality, that ethos. So from anyone that you meet, everyone takes great pride in getting to know the guests that come. And we're very lucky that our guests come back again and again. So you can build up this family kind of relationship.
And it's still going, but you said you're trying to make sure that you stay abreast of what the guest of today expects as well.
Well, I think each of the four Gorings that have run the hotel so far have all wanted not only to maintain this beautiful luxury property, but they've each wanted to make sure that it just doesn't stand still. So from Otto's son, who was OG Goring, he installed, for instance, the very first very, very primitive air conditioning systems into the rooms, which was something that nobody had. We were the first hotel to ever have a bathroom. And this was going back to kind of the late 1920s. And it was sort of successful. It is very kind of amusingly known in the area that these early kind of prototype air conditioning would suck as well as blow air, and did result in a number of ladies' undergarments being blown across the roofs of Belgravia. But we kind of got that one sorted now. So, but each of the subsequent families have decided to move the hotel on. And Jeremy nowadays, he's been at the helm since 2005. And, he's installed a lot of technology into the hotel that we didn't have before, which was something that we kind of carefully approached. We tried it out on a number of our guests to see whether they would cope with you know, wall-mounted digital panels, and everyone's taken to it. So we just need to make sure that we're kind of edging it on for its next 100 years.
And we had the opportunity to hear about Chef Derek and the kitchen, but you keep on tweaking things. So,
yes.
So we're sitting in the archive room, which used to be a dark room with lots of photographs, but instead we're looking out through a picture glass wall into a beautiful garden, and as a result it gives you a great venue for events. So this is the kind of thing you just keep on trying to change?
It is about improvement, and making the best. We are a small hotel. We are just 71 rooms. In fact, when the hotel was built, I think we had 94, but we've kind of knocked some of those through to and into each other. But I mean, one of the things that we can see sitting here is that we have this beautiful private English garden at the back of the hotel, and simply nobody have gardens in hotels in town here in London. You know, so that's something we wanted to make use of. You can get to it from the terrace and from a veranda that we built a couple of years ago. But from this room, and in fact, actually where we're sitting now in the 1950s, this used to be the coal bunker. So it has changed an awful lot. But, you know, we just, again, it's just making the best of things.
Well, this is a very special place. Lots and lots of people that we know stay here. Michael promised we would keep many of them a secret, but the Dame Thatcher apparently pops in from time to time.
Lady Thatcher is a big fan, and wouldn't mind us mentioning her in dispatches, so to speak.
We just missed Danny Meyer from Union Square Hospitality Group. We understand he checked out yesterday. Daniel Hum from 11 Madison Park might still be here. And Chef Derek Quelch actually cooked in his kitchen last year. This is just an ongoing excitement. Listeners, you're going to be able to find out all about how to get into the Goring on our website, so we won't bore you with those details. Michael, thank you so much for talking to us. One last, so we understand you're off to a movie premiere tonight, because you used to be in the movie business. So we know we have to let you go, but if you have a last thought, that would be just terrific.
You know what? This was much more fun, actually, than walking the red carpet, I can assure you. So you can do that any day. This is much more fun. One last thought? Oh, gosh, I don't know. If nothing else, come here to come and see the sheep. And on that little cryptic message, I'll leave you with that.
Well, I don't know the answer to that, listeners, so you're going to have to come and find out for yourselves. Well, we did find out about the sheep, but I think we're going to keep it a mystery, too, so that you'll be tempted to enjoy this wonderful property and find out for yourself what the sheep are all about.
And I must say that the next stop will be the interview with the chef, but I hadn't counted on the food arriving at the same time. I was afraid I was going to lose some of the food while I was doing the interview.
Hey, well, at least you weren't operating the mixer and the microphones at the same time. So we really had our hands full, but it was a very pleasant experience. We raced through several selections from the menu, just sampling, of course.
It was a lot of food.
As we do at this time, but this is a long time. It turned out that he knew some of the other chefs that we've actually interviewed on the
program.
They
all knew each other, really.
Seems like a wonderful little community of chefs. Later on in our trip, in fact, we found out that Lawrence Keogh, the chef at Roast,
had previously been
a chef at the Goring back in the 1990s. So, just like New York, I guess, and all the other fine restaurant cities, there's an underground, a mafia of chefs and managers. And
I wouldn't call it a mafia. I mean,
you wouldn't call it that? Okay. Well,
I don't think that's an appropriate term.
Well, I guess it's not a mafia. It's an association. They're all friends. They all know each other. They all seem to like each other, and it's fun
to be a community.
And it's fun to be a part of that community. But let's not forget that we do have an interview queued up with Chef Derek Quelch. Of the Goring Hotel. So here he is.
We are at absolutely an exquisite private dining room at the Goring Hotel, and it's just been remodeled. It is just so absolutely dazzling, but I'll have Peter talk about that a little bit later with our marketing director. But I'm going to talk to the chef because he needs to get into service, and it's Chef Derek Quelch, and he's very impressive. Chef, hello, thank you, and I'm really impressed with your career, and you're young still, and you've done all these things.
I am, but first of all, welcome to London and the Goring Hotel.
Thank you.
It's nice to have you here. We love you Americans when you come over.
Why? It's not because of the American dollar, I can assure you.
You challenge us. you have done for years, even when you told us how British food was awful, and we have to admit now that you were right all those years ago.
But all I do is rave about British food these days. And it's come so far, and I love it. I wanted to ask you, first of all, you have a funny story from where you were born, because you were a neighbor to the Queen, I understand.
Yeah, to Her Majesty the Queen. I come from Slough in Berkshire, the royal county of Berkshire. Us locals tend to call her Lizzie, but that's a little bit informal. But yes, Slough is right next to Windsor, and we like to tell people that we could wave to her from her bedroom window. It's not strictly true, of course.
But she pulled the curtains.
She pulled the curtains when she was in the bathroom.
Right. Now, I wanted you to run briefly through your career because it's really exemplary in terms of how one gets through the system, understands food from other places, and ends up in the really really senior positions you've been in and spectacular places. Just briefly, how did you get into this business and where did you study?
I always wanted to be a chef or a professional footballer, as all young lads
you
do.
You and Gordon Ramsay?
Yeah. our friend Gordon. At the age of 16, I decided that I no longer wanted to play football. I wanted to be a chef. That's all I wanted to do. So I took an apprenticeship in London, going to college on my day off, which was the norm. Then I'm going back to the 1982. Then from there I went to the Grosvenor House Hotel.
Not shabby.
No, not shabby. I've spent all of my career really in five-star hotels around Europe. So from there I went to the Savoy Grill for 2 years when the Savoy Grill was really in its heyday, unlike now where the Savoy's closed down. Then from there I left and went to the Mayfair Intercontinental for 2 years. And then I decided it was time to go abroad, so I spent 2 years travelling around France, Switzerland, Germany. In France I worked In France I worked in Saint-Jean-Cap-Ferrat at the Hotel du Cap-Ferrat.
Was it rigorous, really rigorous?
It was hard. It was very, very hard because I went there not knowing any of the language.
Oh, that's tough, yeah.
And it was a very, very tough kitchen, but it was a very friendly kitchen, even though I was an Englishman in a French domain. But I had to work very, very hard, not only to prove myself as a cook, but also prove myself as a person. It was a great learning curve for me having to do that. And I often say to my young guys, you need to go abroad. You need to put yourself in these situations because the experience you get is invaluable. Then I went to St. Moritz, did a winter season there at the Baderut Palace.
I bet you met lots of celebrities there.
Yeah, they used to walk around the street, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, I went to Berlin at the Hotel Kempinski on the Kurfürstendamm. That wasn't long after the Berlin Wall came down. I think it was about
really?
9 months, a year after the wall came down. And that was a fantastic experience with the influx of people from the East, from East Germany. And the amalgamation of the East and West and the different cultures and lifestyles of people from the same country.
No wonder you've had so many experiences. No wonder you seem so mature.
Well, my wife and my children wouldn't say that, but it's nice of you to say. Then, after just under a year there, I decided I wanted to go back to France just to brush up on my French. So I went to Courchevel, 1850, at the Hotel Les Arelles. And it was the 92, I believe, Winter Olympics. They had them there, so I worked around that, which was a fantastic experience.
Yeah. I know chefs have done those Olympics. It's very hard. All the private parties you did.
Yes. Long hours, not many days off. But then I decided after 2 years it was time to come home. So I came back to London and I went to the Savoy, back to the Savoy, but in the restaurant kitchen this time by the River Room. And I spent 4 years there as a sous chef, learning the banqueting, how to run a kitchen. And then I transferred after 4 years to Claridge's Hotel, where I was executive sous chef. And then from there I came here, and I've been here for 10 years.
And he's only 4 years old. Now, one of the things you and I were talking about is you've been here 10 years, and I said I noticed that the facility has changed dramatically, and what else has changed? You said everything has changed since you started here 10 years ago. Tell us about that.
Everything has changed. The only thing that hasn't changed is the family's ethos to service to its clients and customers. I'll give you an interesting story. When I first started, I was introduced to Mrs. Edna Goring, who's Jeremy's, who has the hotel at the moment, his grandmother.
Peter's going to talk more about this. It's a family business.
She's passed away now, unfortunately. And the first thing she said to me was, "Welcome to the family." And George Goring said to me, "When people come into this hotel, we're inviting them into our home, and we must never forget that. And that's why that they treat the customers as individuals."
Yeah, well, we're going to stay here next time we're in London. I already decided that. If you have that feeling, the minute you walk in the door, this is a really special place to stay.
It's a very warm place, and that runs through the staff as well. We don't have any animosity between staff. You get this sometimes in places where there's little bits of bitterness between departments. But here, whether you're in the sales office, in the kitchen, in the restaurant, or whether you're one of the kitchen porters, everybody works as a team here, and we have a great, great feeling throughout the hotel. And everybody pulls in the same direction.
And you said also the food and taste, everything has changed too.
It has changed. When I arrived, about 8 years ago, we really decided to focus on British cooking and British produce. And we changed we decided then all our cheeses would be British. So we have a totally British cheese board of 21 cheeses. And we decided to actually start looking locally at where our produce comes from. British products only, working with farmers and local fishermen. Because, you know, we're a small island in this world, but we are surrounded by some of the most fantastic natural products. And we have, of course, the four natural seasons.
We discovered this.
The four seasons that we have, you know, it's nature's beauty. So why should we play around with it? If something's in season, use it. That's when it's at its best.
Now, you have we're talking about, you have modern British cuisine, but you have a lot of twists to this too. And we were talking about, you use a forager.
Yes.
Because I said there are things on this menu I'd never even seen before.
Hogweed. Hogweed, yes. The menu is basically, we do have some traditional things, but we also have a lot of traditional things with a modern twist. But one of the things we have are some wild produce and hogweed, because I have a forager that goes around in the hedgerows around the countryside, picking wild things and send them in for me to cook. And, of course, this is how people used to live years ago off the land.
But you recognize all these things. You're not getting anything that's dangerous or anything.
Well, no, it's not dangerous because the guy that's done it, he's done a lot of research and he knows what's right and what's wrong. But also I went out and bought some books because I was so interested in the subject of looking for something different, but something that's part of our heritage that I wanted to use these products. So I educated myself on these products.
Yeah. The chef from Champignon Sauvage does the same. He has a botanical forager that he goes around with. It's fascinating what you can eat, right?
Yes, and but the thing is, when we go out for walks in the countryside, we probably trample over these things all the time and not realizing what they are.
Right.
So we have hogweed, and we've got some Alexanders. Alexanders is from the celery family.
And that's wild?
It's wild, yes. We've also got some broccoli cress. And we have one or two other bits as well. Chickweed, which is another
chickweed. That one I know. Yeah,
is another wild leaf. And as we go through the seasons, we bring in different things.
And Peter would like to ask a question.
No, I'm simply offering to take the mic because food just arrived in front of us on the table, and I want Anne to get a bite of her lobster omelet while it's still warm. In the meantime, the dish I have in front of me, I think, is smoked haddock with some herbs on top. So that looks like there's some parsley in there, and I just got a bite of that, so I thought it was only fair for Anne to have a turn. Now, Chef Derek, what's coming up next?
Next, you have some scallops. From the Isle of Skye. I have the scallops delivered down to me every day from the fishermen. They're fishing them today, and they'll be here ready to go on the table tomorrow, lunchtime. That's coming with a wild mussel and potato broth. The wild mussels are from the River Fal down in Cornwall. They're very, very nice mussels, and an artichoke puree. And what's interesting about this dish, what I like about it, is it's a good example of taking food from different ends of our tiny island and bringing it together in London and putting it on the plate.
Well, I'm reading, this is a locavore's dream, this menu. Also a dream of sustainability and seasonality. And I'm expecting deliciosity, if there is such a word. Is there any other dish you'd like to mention?
I'm also going to serve for the next course a fillet of Castle of May beef.
You had a story. Tell
yeah, the
story.
Castle of May beef is really from the it's the Queen Mother's or the Royal Estate up in Scotland, and it's an amalgamation of farmers up there. And it's the finest beef you can get in Scotland, and we serve it here. It's an expensive product, but boy, when you taste it, the flavour is absolutely fantastic. And it's all naturally reared beef. There's no additives in their food at all.
Well, I'm looking forward to this, and it's been a pleasure talking to you about it. And I think you're doing service, or I'd just keep you talking forever. But if you have a break in service, come back and talk some more to us.
Absolutely, no problem. It would be a pleasure to.
Thank you so much. Bye.
Bye-bye.
It's time to take a break now, but stay with us because we have a little side adventure down under once again coming up.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back, listeners. Miss Anne was going to say that, but she missed my cue, so I'll just pop it in instead.
Well, you love where we're going anyhow. Why don't you intro? I can't read your shorthand.
You can't read my shorthand because there's no shorthand on this piece of paper because it's all in my head.
Must be very crowded
in there. It is indeed very crowded in my head, but we just can't wait to share with
you. Which is probably why you left your credit card in the bookstore.
That's another story that we don't talk about, but we couldn't wait to include some fine dining and some fine wining that we did in South Australia. So we're going to extend the usual program length and add some wonderful interviews there. First of all, with Jane Ferrari, who represents the Yolumba Winery, one of the oldest producers in Australia.
And, she was fun.
And one of the best. And then one of Miss Anne's absolute favorite adventures. She can't stop talking about it because during lunch at Penfolds McGill Estate, where we had an excellent meal prepared by a French chef in Adelaide, South Australia, we had the opportunity to drink the 1995 Wine Spectator Wine of the Year and 1990 Grange, then called Grange Hermitage, Shiraz-based wine that was the first wine to win the number one wine in the world for Australia and really put Australian wine on the map.
And was it good?
And that was part of the Penfolds adventure. So they're the things that are going to be coming up. If you have the opportunity to stay around and listen to them, I wish you would. If not, you can always download the show and listen for your listening pleasure later. You'll have some of Anne and Peter's great Australian adventures that we're sure you'll find absolutely fascinating.
OTM's latest guest just said to me, Peter, I'm comfortable with you being in control of the interview. Well, I'm going to maintain that control for just about 10 seconds is my guess, because we've spent a couple of hours already with Jane Ferrari, who works for Yolumba, a little wine company in South Australia. And when I asked her what her job was, she said, I'm a storyteller. Well, that's not really true, but it is a good place to start to hear the Yolumba story. So, Jane, what makes Yolumba so special?
Well, I think, to be honest with you, we're an interesting kind of dinosaur. We're 159 years old this year in an industry that's probably 180 years old for this country. Big birthday for us, 160 years next year, and after five generations in the same family here in Australia, there's only three shares. There's mum and the two boys. The managing director, Rob Hill-Smith, is 53 this year. He's had the company for 20 years, been at the helm. His brother Sam is on the board but runs an art gallery in Adelaide. And their mum actually lives on the property as well. She's about 83, not out. And they all play a really active part in the running of the business. And I think it makes us a really interesting, like I said, a dinosaur, because these days, to survive that long, you have to be doing something right. And it's just a lovely place to be.
It's got something to do with the wine as well as the people. Am I right, Jane?
Oh, definitely. But, you know, it starts with the heritage and also where we are too, because we're a 159-year-old family-owned winery right in the middle of the Barossa. We're up on the high side of the Barossa in the Eden Valley, and we crush about 60% of what we crush comes off family-owned vineyards, and we've got these magic vines in this part of the world. It's a viticultural treasure trove. We've got all this pre-European phylloxera, Riesling, Shiraz, Mourvedre, Grenache, all at our disposal, and we have these magic vineyards that are owned by the family, and also vineyards from growers that have been supplying to the family for three, four generations. And they are, yeah, they're the cornerstone of these fantastic wines that we get to make. And when you add to that the fact that we brought Viognier into the country 26 years, well, we didn't bring it in. There was some Montpellier clone Viognier here, but we've brought a lot of very interesting material in since then. 26 years ago, we started a labour of love with Viognier, and we added Viognier to this viticultural treasure trove that we have of pre-European phylloxera vines in the Barossa. So, yeah, it's... Of course, great wines made in the vineyards, and we've got the vines to back it up. So add to that 159 years of heritage, still in the same shape. So I think it's good times.
You said to us a little bit ago, this is an operation that thinks decades into the future. And I guess because his family owns in a position where he can do that. And the Viognier story that you told us this morning is a story about persistence as much as anything else.
Oh, very much so. We started it as a labour of love because we had a really eclectic director that was Australia's representative to the OIV. So he would go to France twice a year and he would try and find something that would really be something special to bring into our world. And he fell in love with Condrieu, the spiritual home of Viognier in the Rhone. He fell in love with the flavours and the texture of this unique wine. If you wanted to make your life easy, you wouldn't deal with Viognier. It's kind of the Pinot Noir of the white world. It's difficult to get along with, but when you get it right, it absolutely shines. And we, no one was making Viognier when we started 26 years ago. In fact, there was only 20 hectares under vine left in the world, I believe. And so what we did is we kind of pioneered away on our own for a long time, and we got it very wrong for 10 years. We made dull, flat, uninteresting wines. And then one day in frustration, just left the vine, left the fruit hang, and lo and behold, once they get really ripe, they develop that lovely apricot that the Condrio folks say you must have as a characteristic, and the texture. And we were lucky enough to have an absolutely outstanding, exceptional winemaker, Louisa Rose, who could really get the expression of the fruit right. And we've persisted with hand-picking, with bag pressing, whole bunch pressing, 100% wild yeast ferment, 100% no malolactic fermentation at all. In fact, it's actively discouraged. And we use a lot of really smart old French oak to ferment in. And we've been able to get some extraordinary texture and balance, as well as this lovely expression of apricot, stone fruit, nougat, and occasionally the lemongrass and ginger. We've come to a point now where I think it would be fair to say that we've almost reintroduced a lot of the world to Viognier via Australia.
Now, you're also using Viognier in a way that wasn't done in Australia until a relatively short time ago, which is what the French have done for a long time in Côte-Rôtie. So tell us about that aspect of the Yolumba operation where you're using a white grape to make a red wine better.
Oh, yeah. Well, if you have a look at what Australia does in a winemaking sense, 95% of what we do stylistically is dictated by the old world. And we recognise that. Once we got on top of the expression, the fruit expression and the textural expression of Viognier, we decided to have a crack at one of the great wines, of the Rhone, which is the Côte Rôtie. And you got to remember that the Barossa is really Mediterranean. It's hot, dry summers, cold, wet winters, and it looks a lot, you know, like the Rhone. So essentially what we did is we decided to have a go at the co-fermentation of Shiraz and Viognier. And, of course, in the Côte Rôtie, they have the Viognier growing amongst the Shiraz, so they just pick it together. And what we did is we started with finished wine. We progressed to putting Viognier skins in Shiraz ferments and vice versa. As we moved along the road, starting in about 1998, we ended up putting ferments together, and then we started crushing fruit together. And what happens is when you get Shiraz and Viognier together, and you only need a drop in the bucket, you only need a tiny bit of Viognier to make this effect happen, and the most that we have in the blend is 5% Viognier, 95% Shiraz. But what happens is the Viognier has a definite action on the Shiraz, and you get three things that you can see. The first thing, the Viognier fixes and deepens the hue of the colour. So you get these really rich, bold colours that are really deep, but they're really glossy and shiny at the same time. So really healthy. Then you get the Viognier cleaves open the Shiraz aromatic, and you get these lovely lifted, sort of jet lift, almost floral, pretty aromas that people don't generally associate with Shiraz from our world. And the third thing that happens is it kind of softens up or tenderises the front palate, and you get this lovely fruit drop of crushed velour, velvety fruit at the opening, then the tannin kind of dries off across the middle of your tongue and the fruit slides in underneath again as a secondary palate. And you get these lovely, we use a lot of Eden Valley Shiraz with the Viognier. And Eden Valley generally is a little bit cooler up there in the high side of the Barossa. And it's a little bit leaner, the wines, a little bit more elegant, a little bit more floral in their lift. A lot of fresh plums instead of prunes that you get off the valley floor. A lot more of the licorice rather than the big deep aniseed characters. So what happens is you get kind of these atypical kind of almost jet lift aromatic, leaner, kind of more elegant Shirazes that are just magic for food.
But you're also making a more traditional Australian Shiraz too at a very high quality. Tell us a little bit about that one.
Oh yeah, we have a Shiraz that we make called the Octavius, and it's a real tribute to the tremendous gnarly old vineyards that do exist here in the Barossa that are over 75, 80 years of age on their own roots. And we have over 80 different clones of Shiraz here in the Barossa. So, you know, we get guys like Mark Chaputio coming out to the Barossa saying that you've got a huge range of flavour and aroma expressions for your Shiraz and Grenache that they hardly see even in France. So we tap into this beautiful treasure trove of vines that we have, and they generally are low yielding because they're in perfect synergy with their immediate environment, which some folks call terroir. We get this beautiful, low-yielding, very intense, huge range of flavours that we can work with and unique to different vineyards. And as the dirt and the cool air that flows over the Barossa shifts and changes, you get this lovely change in expression of fruit. So we get these big, deep, dark, rich wines that are quite elegant. We use both French and American oak. Years ago, it was just American oak, and it was a bit too bold, a bit over the top. But these days, we use French and American oak. So you get the elegant spice, and you get that lovely vanilla fudge that is, you know, American oak that goes so nicely and dances so well with Shiraz. You know, with all the plum, the aniseed, the clove, you know, the plum pudding, Christmas pudding kind of things that really do stand head and shoulders above most other regions when you're talking Shiraz, and they just stamp Barossa.
So they're making lots of great stuff. And if you go to the Yalimba website, there's wine after wine after wine. There are all kinds of different grapes they make. The three we tasted today at the top of the line are the ones I want you to reference as we go through. Because listeners, if you see these on a restaurant wine list, if you see these in a wine store, don't muck around. As Jane said off camera, don't muck around. Buy them, drink one just so you know what treat you'll have in store, and then sell the rest for about how long, Jane? Just mention that as you go through the three wines.
The Octavius is really open-ended. We've got some lovely Octavius wines that are 12, 15 years old, and they're holding together beautifully, and they're made for the longer journey. It's actually called Octavius because they're aged in small oak barrels, 90-litre barrels called Octaves, and they're built for the longer journey. So really, a lot of folks, you know, with oil that's at $100 a barrel, a lot of the stockbrokers in Manhattan can actually drink that Octavius with a steak sandwich for lunch tomorrow and go again the next day. But for us, it's a special occasion wine, but it will last as long as you leave it, guaranteed, for at least 15 to 16 years. The Vigilius, it's interesting because we often get asked, what do you think about Vigilius? What do you think about Eden Valley Viognier? And for me, for Viognier, have it while it's really fresh. 1 or 2 years from its vintage date. We asked the French folks, actually. We said, what do you do with your best Viogniers? And they gave us a particularly French answer. They said, our best Viogniers are best drunk young. But our best Viogniers go into a dormancy period of 10 to 12 years where it's like they go into a cocoon and go dormant. And then they blossom at the end like butterflies coming out of a cocoon. So it really covers every eventuality, whatever time you open that wine. But for us, really fresh. Our whole world is Mediterranean food here. 95% of the population lives within 60 kilometres of the coast. So it's all about seafood, Mediterranean food. So absolutely the best way to go is fresh as, while it's really exotic and while it's really jumping out of the bottle.
And what about your Côte Rôtie equivalent?
Oh, the Shiraz Viogniers, the ones that we have released at the moment are 2005 and 2006, and two particularly strong years for us in the Barossa. I like them now, but I think they're going to stretch their legs over the next 4, 5, 6 years. And as I said today, a lot of the food we have is share plate, tapas, mezes, antipasto, dim sum. So you're looking at olive oil, you're looking at black olives, tomato, garlic, onion, lamb, minced lamb, so char grilled. So I would say they are great now because they're really quite soft, velvety, approachable and lifted. But over the next 3, 4, 5, 6 years, they are definitely going to stretch their legs. So I think you try them. I don't think we'll let you down anywhere out to 5 years.
Now the wine that was in that category has a special name. Can you just say that as you conclude, and then just add a last thought for OTM listeners?
What was that? Which one? Oh, the hand-picked Shiraz Viognier. Yeah, it's the hand-picked Shiraz Viognier. It's from Eden Valley fruit, generally speaking. And it's just the more elegant, almost atypical Shiraz that you would find in the Barossa, and hand-picked because it's small volume that we make, and it is all hand-picked and hand-worked.
Jane, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to On the Menu. You got up at 4 o'clock this morning somewhere else. You have tremendous stamina. Now we're going to sit down, and we're going to do some serious wine drinking and eating at a restaurant you really like, so why don't we put in a plug for them too.
Oh yeah, it's a tremendous operation down here just outside the village of Angaston. It's called Vintner's Restaurant. It's right in the middle of a vineyard. The chef Peter Clark's from New Zealand, married a local girl, just does some magic food. And tonight's special is Marin, which is going to be served up on a bed of Asian greens. I think you're having that. I'm having this most amazing chicken dish with a coriander salsa. I think we're in for a good time because there's no point making wine if it can't go with food. So we'll see how they go.
So we tasted some wine this morning, and we're going to come back and finish the rest of it at dinner time.
His listeners, have you noticed how very shy and retiring this woman is? We're having a really wonderful time.
Thanks, Anne, for chiming in. And Ms. Ferrari, thank you so much for talking to us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks very much for coming all this way. It's a treat. No problem at all.
You can't deal with wine in Australia without coming to Penfolds McGill Estate and hearing the story of the iconic wine Grange. So we have the opportunity to talk to Jamie Sash, who has the wonderful title of Wine Ambassador, and who just showed us around this estate. But tell us the story, Jamie.
Well, Penfolds Grange is certainly regarded as one of Australia's great icon wines. And it really, the development of Grange in the early 1950s by Max Schubert, Penfolds winemaker, marked, I guess, the swing from Australians drinking fortified wine styles to table wine styles. So it was a fairly historic moment in Australia's wine history. Grange, as I mentioned, was made by Max Schubert, who had actually started working for Penfolds back in the 1930s. He started at the Nuriupa Winery in the Barossa Valley as an errand boy and slowly worked his way through the ranks before going to World War II and fighting. After he'd returned from active service, he was made chief of production, the equivalent of a chief winemaker's position at the Penfolds McGill Estate Winery, which was still our number one production facility in the 1950s. Max was the first non-Penfolds family member to be sent on a fact-finding mission. They packed him up and sent him off to Portugal and to Spain to learn about fortified wine production, because back in those days, fortified wine production was the lion's share of what Penfolds made and what was made elsewhere in Australia. In fact, they were the wines that Dr. Christopher Rawson Penfold was making as tonics for his patients when he first arrived in Australia back in 1844 and established the Penfolds business name. So,
but when Max came back from France, I think you told me, and I've seen reports that after he started making this wine called Grange, people thought he was quite mad.
Well, indeed. Schubert, well, when he was sent on this study mission, was spent most of his time in Spain and Portugal, but fortunately for us, had an opportunity to take a holiday in the south of France and visit Bordeaux towards the end of his journey. And he was shown around a number of chateaus by a famous negociant called Christian Cruz, and was able to taste some beautiful Bordeaux wines that were 20, 30, 40 years old, and was inspired that upon his return to Australia, he would also develop an Australian wine style which had the capacity to age gracefully for many decades in the cellar. Of course, you know, upon returning to Australia, he realised that there were a number of things that he would need to do quite differently to what he'd observed in Bordeaux. For one, Cabernet Sauvignon wasn't widely planted in South Australia at the time. There was a small patch of vines known as Block 42 in our Kalimna vineyard, which had been planted in the mid-1880s, which must have played on Schubert's mind. But he realised that the varietal and the Barossa wouldn't always perform up to the standards that he wanted. So rather than concentrate his attention to Cabernet, he turned to Shiraz as the grape of choice. He also realised that in Australia at the time, of course, there was no French oak. We weren't using French oak barrels for anything. So he needed to adapt his winemaking to maturation with American oak. And the third major obstacle, I guess, or challenge in front of Schubert was that we were harvesting Shiraz in Australia here in February and March. As you can tell from the temperature outside today, it's 38 degrees centigrade, which is over 100 on the old scale. So it's pretty warm out there today. And in France, when they're harvesting their Cabernet, it's autumn, it's much cooler, and therefore the fermentations take a longer period of time to get through. Whereas if you allowed a Shiraz fermentation to go through in Australia at 38 degrees, it would be over and done with in no time at all. So Schubert developed a means of temperature controlling his ferments, thus drawing out the fermentation and extracting wonderful flavours, flavour and colour and tannin from the grape skins. He also pioneered the barrel fermentation technique in Australia, where the fermentation, the last three or four bome of sugar to ferment out, actually occurred in the barrel. And that gives our wines a lovely synergy between the fruit flavours and the oak flavours in the wine. But, of course, in the early days, this was all radical winemaking. These days in Australia, it's commonplace to find these sorts of practices, but certainly not in 1951, 1952, when Schubert was first doing it and first showing these wines to his colleagues and other people in the business. And he was mocked for it in the early days. Indeed, even within the Penfolds regime at the time, the family members running the company, many of them thought that he was quite mad. But they let him go for a while. But in 1957, he was ordered to meet the board of directors and put on a vertical tasting of all the wines he'd made to that point. And they universally despised the wine. In fact, the minutes of the board meetings are quite entertaining to read now, but I'm sure Schubert felt quite despondent when he left that meeting. Not despondent enough to stop making the wine, however, even though they ordered him to cease production, with a bit of a wink and a nod from Geoffrey Penfold Highland, who is the family member in charge of things here in South Australia. He was actually allowed to continue making Grange, but in secret. So none of the other family members knew what was going on. Just Geoffrey and Max were complicit in this plot. And they managed to keep it going, not just for one vintage, but for three consecutive vintages. And it wasn't until 1960 when the family started singing a different tune. Some of these earlier wines were beginning to drink very well. They started revisiting them and thinking about it and told Schubert that he could go back into production. And that's when he confessed what he'd done and very nearly lost his job. If it wasn't for Geoffrey, he probably would have. And he was allowed to continue Grange production. In fact, from that stage on, he was encouraged to do so. And it really wasn't, he wasn't completely vindicated until 1962 when the 55 Grange, a wine he always considered to be one of his favourites, won a gold medal at the Sydney Wine Show. So that was, I guess, the real turning point for Max and the real acknowledgement.
So now you've got a complete series in the cellar that we saw. So the bootleg years are now included in that collection?
Yeah, well, we call them the Hidden Granges. And yes, we do have a full set here. There's a number of full sets in existence in Australia. They sell for astronomical prices now. The 51, the first experimental vintage, which Schubert couldn't give away. You know, he was selling it to the cellar hands here at McGill for a shilling a bottle, at the time. That's now worth over $50,000, if the bottle's, of course, in good condition. Some of the other vintages, the early wines from the 1950s, the 53. In fact, Schubert made a Grange Cabernet in 1953 using the beautiful old vine material, which we think are the oldest Cabernet vines, continuously producing Cabernet vines in the world, from Block 42 in 1953. It was the Grange Bin 9 Grange Cabernet. And that's still one of the most outstanding wines in Australia. So it's drinking beautifully still today, all these years down the track. And many of the other early vintages are still drinking well. In fact, last September, we opened up every vintage of Grange except for the 51. So every commercial release from 52 through to wines that have only just been bottled from the last vintage. And we showed it to a panel of experts at the Penfolds Rewards of Patience tastings at Adelaide Oval last September. And it was remarkable to see that not only can you find a drinkable example of every vintage of Grange going all the way back to that first commercial release in 52, but that many of the wines from the 50s and 60s are still drinking magnificently today. And the great 55, if in found in good condition, looks like it's probably got another 10 years to go. Who knows quite how long some of these wines will kick on, but if they've been carefully cellared and perhaps bought into a recorking clinic, then they might live to be 60 or 70 years old. We'll just have to wait and see.
So Schubert was a change maker with the help of his friend Geoffrey Highland, and wine drinkers around the world are grateful. Not for nothing has the Grange won Wine Spectator's Wine of the Year on several occasions. It's a landmark bottling today. Is there anything about it that's changed now? There's now another winemaker in charge. But is he doing anything different?
No, not at all. In fact, Peter's very protective of the Penfolds portfolio, not only Grange, but all of the other wines in the portfolio. We're not trying to alter or change the style of any of those wines that Schubert pioneered, be it Grange, be it 389, or the great St. Henri. Indeed, our job is to continue making wines to that style. If anything, just to slightly refine and improve upon what we've been doing over the years, but not to make wholesale changes to the style of wine at all. But that's not to say that we're not innovating and doing different things. As you've seen from the tour today in the cellars, that we make a number of different wine styles. We have a range of wines called our cellar reserve wines, which allow us to innovate and do different things from time to time. We make a cellar reserve Pinot Noir, a Sangiovese, and periodically we also release a cellar reserve Cabernet Sauvignon from Block 42, and we also have a range of wines that we call special bins. Now, special bins are only made in exceptional vintages, when we can isolate small parcels from premium vineyards in the Barossa, sometimes from the Coonawarra as well, Oftentimes they're blends of Cabernet Sauvignon and Shiraz, a unique Australian wine style. Some of those wines have the capacity to age gracefully for many decades. The most famous of which, of course, was made in 1962, Penfold's Bin 60A, which is now selling for over $3,000 a bottle at auction. And that was a blend of Coonawarra Cabernet and Barossa Valley Shiraz from the Kalimna Vineyard, a quite exceptional wine. So these are the sorts of things that allow us to work a little bit outside of the square, if you like. But with the heartland of Penfolds, we don't try to alter things. We're just trying to carry on a grand tradition.
Well, if you're doing an Australian wine tour, this is as good a place as any to start. It's 25 minutes from the Adelaide International Airport and in the foothills sitting up above the city. www.penfolds.com.au is the website, Jamie?
That's correct. There is also a penfolds.com website as well, so either will get you there.
Well, thank you so much for talking to us and telling us about this wonderful story of someone doing something in secret that turned out to be immensely successful.
Great. Well, thank you for coming to visit us. Hope you come again.
It's now approaching time for lunch, and our menu seems to be particularly hungry today, even though we just had some wonderful cake and clotted cream. We're talking to Jérôme Trémoulet, who is the head chef, executive chef, of the Penfolds restaurant. Hello, Jérôme.
Hi, how are you?
You are from Toulouse. You're France-born, but you are what we would call peripatetic, meaning you move around quite a lot. Just trace your steps. Tell us all the different places you've been.
Basically, I work, I started to work probably more than 20 years ago now. Moved from, of course, France to Switzerland. Then after Switzerland, I moved to England for 4 years. Then I moved to Melbourne for 5, back to France for 2.5, moved to Sydney for nearly 4 years. Then after that, Sydney, I went to California for 2 years, and I've been in Adelaide now for the past 3 years. Next month.
Are you just naturally restless?
Yes.
You started cooking when you were 14. This seems to be par for the course. You apprenticed, did you?
First of all, yes. I started working on a farm when I was actually 12 years old in the summer. And then, I worked at the kitchen hand at the age of 14. And then I went to school and did an apprenticeship.
Now, your style of cooking is obviously, since it's French-based, French technique. But in Australia, you were talking before about the local products you use. Tell us what some of those are.
Yes, in Australia we try to use as much as local as we can. I mean, of course, there's other things we cannot and we have to export. But otherwise, yeah, I try to use, I use crayfish from Kangaroo Island, whiting from Kangaroo Island, as much as possible from South Australia.
I also asked you what was one thing that you missed, and what did you say?
The one thing I miss is actually fresh foie gras, which is not allowed in Australia. That's the only thing I probably miss, yeah.
We're going to be having lunch here. Could you just talk through some of these items on the menu that are pretty much signature items, starting with the entree, which is the same as an app. Here's grilled King George whiting.
Yeah, we're very lucky here. We get fresh fish daily. So we got a nice grilled whiting with some, I do a corn puree with white vegetables only, and with some corn, and I just basically cook it for about half an hour, strain it, and then blend it, and they serve this as a puree with some nice whiting and crayfish oil, you know.
Sounds good to me. And talk us through the timbale of duck confit, which is another signature.
Timbale of duck confit, I mean, duck is big in south of France, you know, everybody loves ducks. So basically here we just marinate the duck for 48 hours with a lot of vegetables, like a puree of vegetables. So I marinate all my duck, like I said, and then I just wash it, dry it, and cook it in duck fat for about 4 hours. When it's cooked, I shred it, and I mix it with some garlic cream, some parsley, same with the spinach puree, some gizzard, and some smoked duck breast.
I love gizzards. Nobody seems to use them anymore.
No, I think people are a bit afraid of it. I think they call that giblet. People use gizzard or giblet. And sometimes I think if you don't mention on the menu and you serve it, they eat it. But as soon as they see the name, they're like, wow, you know, it's not for me, you know.
In your mains now, you obviously use Australian lamb, South Australian lamb. How is that different from lamb you've used elsewhere?
Well, it's interesting. I haven't, before I came here, I didn't eat lamb for 10 or 15 years because I didn't like it. So it's only when I actually moved back to South Australia when I started with lamb. I used to find it too strong. But yeah, I have to say, I mean, we got very, very good lamb and beef in South Australia. I mean, all Australia, we're very lucky with the product. I'm very lucky with the fish as well. We got, you know, fresh fish daily, which is fantastic.
Now, you also have a cheese menu. That's very French too, isn't it? What's on your menu?
Well, we got French and, you know, we try to use as well some, you know, Australian cheese as well. You know, we got to be fair.
Which are the Australian cheeses that you particularly like?
Australian cheese I like. It's a tough question because I eat any type of cheese, you know. I don't eat much dessert myself. You know, I prefer to have a nice cheese. But I don't know, it's hard to say. I mean, the Woodside always been good. Woodside Vigneron is a nice cheese. What else I can tell you? Gippsland Blue as well. That's nice, you know. From Victoria, but they're pretty. I think cheese really improved a lot here in Australia the last 4 or 5 years. You know, they're very, very good cheese.
And of course, it's very important to go with the wine. I mean, you must think about the wine since you're on the McGill Estate when you do design your menu.
Yes, I mean we work very close with you know, the waiters, sommelier, the restaurant manager, and we actually do tasting. We try the wine. You know, we do this quite a few times a year, at least 3 times a year, like we sit down and try to match everything with the wine, which is very, very interesting. And that's the difference to work in the restaurant in winery, you know, because you really have to make sure it's not, you know, sometimes if it's too spicy or, you know, you can't really use some different wines. So it's...
Now, you don't like dessert that much, but you have an enormous dessert menu. Tell us the ones that you were pointing out to me earlier. As the star anise infused stone fruit. Tell us about that.
It's basically, I mean, good season for fruit at the moment. So we just take peach or nectarine. We just roast them with some vanilla beans in the oven, icing sugar, some star anise. You know, you just bake in the oven for about an hour. And then we just serve this with some really creamy polenta, biscotti, you know, and balsamic.
And now, of course, a classic. Passion fruit souffle, why not?
Well, passion fruit, as again, good time of the season. And souffle, who don't like souffle? You know, I mean, you know, it doesn't matter which souffle you do. But passion fruit, a lot of flavor, good smell. I mean, sooner you do it, you walk in the restaurant and it's, wow. You know, you can smell it far away. So.
Yeah, it's very expensive in the States, but since we've been in Australia, I've been having passion fruit every day for breakfast.
Same to me.
Well, listen, I'm really looking forward to tasting this. You seem to be a young man with very strong preferences and you have a lot of confidence, and I'm sure that translates into delicious dishes. Do you have a word for anybody who wants to come here?
Yes, I mean, definitely. We are situated about 7K away from the city. So, I mean, like today, if you look outside right now, it's beautiful, you know, sunshine. You know, you can look at the winery. You actually can see the sea from here, you know, where else you want to be, you know.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
So that, listeners, I guess, is what you call a wrap. It's a program of record length, but we certainly hope you enjoyed it because we think there were some wonderful guests and some wonderful adventures that we hope you'll be able to follow.
There's so many wonderful people, interesting people in the world to meet, and I certainly hope we do go again. Probably will. With that, I guess we say goodbye.
Until the same time, same place, next week, when we hope you'll be back with On the Menu Radio.
Bye-bye.